Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your moderator, and my name is Valerie St. Rossi. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Michael Gora, who will be speaking about his book, The Bells in Their Silence, Travels Through Germany. This was published by Princeton University Press. Mr. Gora, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
I would like to tell our listeners a little about you. You are the Mary Augusta Jordan Professor of English at Smith College, where you have been on the faculty since 1985. Your books include the Pulitzer Prize-nominated Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. Other titles are After Empire, Scott, Naipaul, Rushdie, and The English Novel at Mid-Century. You have also been the editor of editions of Faulkner, Henry James, as well as the editor of The Portable Conrad. And you are a distinguished book reviewer, recognized by the National Book Critics Circle for this work. Your reviews have appeared on both sides of the Atlantic, in many newspapers, and in magazines, Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Book Review, Boston Globe, LA Times, Times Literary Supplement, Wall Street Journal, Slate, The Daily Beast, and even the long-lamented Washington Post Book World. I want to thank you so much for joining us to talk about your book. Now, I'm going to ask you to take us to Germany. The Bells in Their Silence is remarkable to me because it's an apolitical book about a country that it is very difficult to view in an apolitical way. And yet, this book, you could say, has its eyes wide open. Could you please tell us how you came to write about Germany?
In some ways, it was a great surprise to me. And I suppose that to define that, I have to go back to where exactly in my own life the book came. I had written two books about novels. And at that point, I decided that I wasn't going to learn anything more by simply, at that point in my career, getting to be 40, say, I wasn't going to learn anything more by simply writing another book about fiction. And so I decided to look around for something else to write about. I wanted to see whether I was even capable of writing about things other than novels. I'd been interested in travel writing for a long time. I had started teaching a course on travel writing and decided why not try it myself? The decision to do that dovetailed with a couple of other things. My college has a faculty exchange with the University of Hamburg, and I managed to talk them into letting me go, even though I spoke no German at the time. So I talked about post-colonial literature in Hamburg, about Rushdie and Naipaul. And then my wife, who does speak German, was asked to direct this year-long study abroad program we had there. And that came about right at the moment that I was thinking I needed to find something else to write about. So I sort of piggybacked on her, on the professional opportunity she had, and started reading madly. I read a lot of travel books. I read a lot of German history. I started to read as much German literature as I could, and then that became the bulk of my reading during the year we were in Hamburg. And as I was doing this reading, I kept on being startled by one thing, which is that I wasn't able to find travel books about Germany. There were guidebooks, there were serious journalistic accounts of the country, but travel books, books that were at once, as Bill Bryson says, neither here nor there, that were about being in a particular place and yet had the air of inconsequentiality that travel books often have, that we find, say, in reading Paul Theroux, in reading sometimes Bruce Chatwin. There weren't books like that about Germany, and I kept on asking myself why. And clearly I thought it, because in the 19th century there were Anglo-American travel books about the country. Clearly it had something to do with the course of Germany's history since the 30s, that Germany seemed to be a place, well, if travel books are a genre for amateurs, for people who are enthusiastic about a place but are subjecting themselves often to a new place, Germany was a place for professionals. It was a place for historians. It was a place for journalists. It wasn't a place for somebody like me who just wanted to walk down a street and see what he was thinking as he did it. And yet that made it an interesting problem. It made writing about Germany not just an exercise in writing about Germany, but it made it it meant that I had to think hard about genre, about what about Germany meant that it didn't fit in with the genre of the travel book, which is after all, a capacious genre. It's one that Goethe has worked in, and Henry James, and Flaubert, Rebecca West, Sybil Bedford. What was it about Germany that meant that it didn't fit, that it was left to reporters? So I asked myself that question, and the book I produced is an odd book. I know that's not what I should say in talking for a podcast about my own work, but it is a little odd in that it's a fusion of genres. It has as its epigraph a line from the 19th century German geographer Wilhelm Heinrich Riehl that goes something like this: "We wander about in open country so as to learn how to wander about in the dusty world of books." And that's what I tried to do, to visit this city, that city, this bit of the countryside, these mountains, to live in the place in order to learn how to orient myself in the world of books in terms of German literature, German history, and so on.
I don't think it's a bad thing to describe a book as odd, because it catches a person's curiosity. We could say that Alice in Wonderland is an odd book too, and yet it lives forever. As a matter of fact, I was wondering whether when you started to take on this project, did it feel a little like immersing yourself in Lewis Carroll's Caucus Race? Because did you know where the beginning or the end or the top or the bottom was going to be?
No, I had no idea. And in that way, you know, some travel books are about a journey that starts at point A and goes to point B. It chronicles an actual trip. I was living in Hamburg for a year. I didn't know where the beginning was. I didn't know what the end was. The book is not at all linear in any straightforward sense. But I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know for a long time whether there was going to be a book or just a collection of observations. I struggled for a long time with the form, and finally found that it worked best when each of my chapters managed to put that sense of experience on the ground up against a set of textual experiences, up against novels, essays, poems. That's where the book seemed to come alive.
I'm curious to know, when you actually began working on it full-time, or as much full-time as one can, how long did it take you to write it?
That's a hard question to answer, because I began by writing a series of what I thought were going to be short chapters, chapters ranging anywhere from 5 to 15 pages in manuscript. And I got a bunch of those up and running, maybe 100 pages worth, and sent them to an editor I'd worked with before, and he sent them back and said, you know, not quite. So I then spent a summer or more rejigging them in the ways he suggested, putting the textual encounters up against the account of life on the ground. And then found I needed a number of more chapters to do that. The year we were in Germany was in 1997-98. I went back there for extended visits in the summers of 2000 and 2001, and again in 2002. And by the end of 2002, certainly I had found the form. And then it took about another year to finish putting it together. But I think the process of actual writing was, it was a protracted one.
I'm thinking about George Eliot as you're speaking, because her visit to Weimar to visit Goethe was a very 19th century experience. It unfolded over time, just the way you're describing your own process through finding what your book would be.
Right.
And I think there's really, I would like to commend you for not being in a hurry, because we can miss what the point of a place is when it gets put down too fast. And because there are so many travel articles now and travel writing and essays that tell us not enough.
Well, I think that, you know, the danger of travel writing is superficiality.
Yes.
Yeah, I was this weekend I was reading the Times travel section. And you know, and frankly, there was an article on the joys of left bank Paris that was presenting itself as saying something new, and I thought, yep, done that. It was all the most familiar things, and that's frustrating. That travel writing tends to revisit the same places over and over again and to say the same things over and over again. I had a certain amount of luxury, which is that I have a day job. I teach for my income, for my living. I was not under any pressure to produce at any given rate, except a kind of self-directed pressure. So I had the luxury of allowing what I was finding and thinking and reading about to take the time it needed to find its own shape. And that's a great luxury, and I know that not many people have that. I also thought, though, that it would be about Germany very easy to write something superficial, to write something touristic on the one hand and talk about the beauties of the Rhine and so on, or to write something about, you know, how much the history depresses you. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to find some way of registering the complexity. I guess the complexity of my own response it sounds like I'm patting myself on the back, but I don't mean to do that, but that one's responses to a place are variegated. You are appalled at one moment and fascinated at another. And then a lot of it is just when you're living in a place, a lot of it is just ordinary life where you go to the grocery store and out with friends. And I wanted to get that part in too, as well as the meditation on history that is a large part of what the book offers.
Well, I can certainly say that as a person who lives in New York, I range between being fascinated and appalled numerous times every day. And I think that everyone who lives somewhere finds that absolutely normal life. There is something that I'd like to mention that connects with the history of America and our German background, which has, because of two world wars fought with Germany, become so buried and covered. And yet even New York was an intensely German town in the most fascinating way in the 19th century. I have spoken to people over the years who told me that either in the 20s or in the 30s, their family changed their last names so they wouldn't sound German.
I've heard that often.
And we ourselves have not been able to let what is German about America be as apparent as it could be.
Right. No, I've heard that often about people changing their names. In fact, one of my colleagues here, a man in the German department, Joseph McVeigh, teaches a course on German America and the ways in which basically a German ancestry and cultural identity went underground, starting in the teens. The teens with the response to World War I, and it reasserted itself to some degree in the 30s with Lindbergh, say, and the German-American Bund, and then went underground again. But a couple of times I've, for some reason, been in Manhattan. I think in early October, there's always a weekend when there's a German parade, Steuben Day,
right.
Celebrating the Prussian, I think he's a Prussian, who was one of Washington's officers, and their Steuben societies. They all seem to come from Pennsylvania, actually, but they were up in New York for a parade. I think that this is a place where, well, even German literature is not as translated, not as well known in this country as it might be, as it could be. If you go to, I remember going around the time I started this project, I went to a large Borders in suburban Hartford and walked through, you know, one with a big history section, and walked through the shelves of German history, and there was a bookcase full, but almost all of it was 20th century history. And almost all of it dealt with either World War II or the Holocaust. You're hard put to find anything on 19th century Germany. Hard put to find anything on the Holy Roman Empire or on aspects of German culture that were not basically pointing towards 20th century disasters.
One of the interesting things that I found in the book was the description of how regional the territories make up Germany were. And it made me think of Italy, which has always been a country that does not consider itself a country, but a group of regions. If you talk to anyone who's Italian, they say, I'm Tuscan, I'm Sicilian, I'm from Puglia. People don't really identify nationally unless they go outside of the country, and then they're caring their passport, which says they are from Italy.
And Germany as well, in many ways.
Yeah.
So go ahead, and then I'll answer.
You described it that the riverine middle was Prussian, Baden, I'm forgetting what the third region was, and that's what people considered themselves.
Well,
throughout the 19th century, well, because Bismarck didn't pull Germany together as a political entity until it was in 1871.
I think, in fact, that sense of regional identity is still very strong. Now there are a couple of wrinkles to it. Part of it is a survival from the 19th century. Germany, like Italy, is in many ways a decentered polity. A lot of Italians don't like Rome. They don't like the pull of Rome, the centralization of Rome. Well, there are a lot of Germans who feel that way about Berlin, have always felt that way about Berlin. The Bonn Republic, what we call West Germany, decentered its own institutions. The legislature was in Bonn. I think the courts were in, the money was in Frankfurt. The courts were in another city. That the government functions were spread quite widely throughout the country. That, in a way, reflects the idea that going back to the 19th century and earlier, that Germany was more a culture and a language than it was a state. It wasn't a state. It was many states. In the 20th century, or rather post-World War II, I think a lot of Germans felt more comfortable asserting or talking or speaking of themselves in terms of a regional identity rather than a national identity, in part because nationalism, the nation, was a tainted category after the Third Reich. And then also, of course, there were two nations. There was East and West. Which Germany are you speaking of? So people spoke of themselves as Bavarians, or as people in the East from Thuringia or Saxon. People in the north of Germany were from Schleswig-Holstein. There was a real sense of regional difference. In Hamburg, I noticed, and I found this oddly enough, in real estate ads, they talked about the style of architecture as being Hanseatic.
Hanseatic, yeah. I was very tickled by that description.
It's an assertion of an older pre-national identity, an identity that goes back really to the Middle Ages, but this sense of the North German mercantile cities as having a culture of their own that was not the same as the culture of the rest of what we call Germany, that was oriented outwards, that was proper in Mainz Buddenbrooks, which is the codification of the Hanseatic ideal. They speak of Bavarians as people who hardly speak German at all.
It made me think of the New Englanders, the clipper ship empire.
Yes.
That really is separate from the... That society had its own identity, just the same way the Hanseatic Northern Germans.
Right, and if you go to Salem, Massachusetts, and go to the Peabody Essex Museum, you feel that because you have a sense of, we think of Salem mostly as the witch trials, perhaps, but if you actually study the history of that region, what you really think of it is in terms of the China trade, of this very proud mercantile tradition.
Lucrative and global before... America was global?
Yes, yes.
And damn proud of it, too.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's interesting that northern parts of countries sometimes have these similarities. And also they look down on southerners as not speaking English.
Yes.
Or not speaking German.
Right. And God knows that's the north-south divides in Italy are...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they're utterly crucial. utterly and that otherwise impeccably people whose politics are otherwise impeccable will speak of the North-South divide as ineradicable and natural. The exception to this, it's that North-South divide holds in France too. The exception, oddly, I think, is in England, where in effect the south of the country functions as the north.
It's probably one of the few examples in the world where the south is on top.
Right.
In Italy, the guest arbeiters are Italians from the south.
Yes.
But they're treated just as casually as Turkish guest arbeiters have been in Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
As a social group.
Exactly, yeah.
Not quite echt.
Right.
Now, I it's a question in my mind whether what you have written is a travel book.
Mm-hmm.
I found, and in our conversation it's been coming out as well, that I have learned so much about European historical interactions in Western Europe from reading your book. I learned a lot about the Hanseatic League. I became familiar with many things that go beyond I'm just reading about Germany. And I'm so grateful to have the means to do that. We find ourselves now redefining the stature of the countries of Western Europe. And when you were talking about looking back on earlier German history to the Hanseatic League, I was reminded of something that a Greek friend has told me, which was that why do people look back to ancient Greece when so much of Greece history is really based on Byzantium and Byzantine culture, philosophy, history? But we, our education has fast-tracked us straight back to the ancient, skipping over important parts of the closer historical times. And the same way, I felt that there were so many things in our American university education that do not provide us with that kind of cultural currency that would help us form opinions that are based on more than the past 50 years. I do want to say that you have glossed over nothing in German history of the 20th century. And you have made it clear that there are things that remain uncomfortable for people in downtown Hamburg. In terms of passing landmarks that are there to remind citizens of remind citizens not to forget. I wonder if you could say a little about that and how you found a way to speak about Weimar and Buchenwald in the same chapter.
Well, this is the German conundrum, the complexity, the problem for us. I think I'm okay. I think essentially I'm an American. I'm a fairly provincial American. I didn't grow up traveling very much. I grew up in New England and didn't go anywhere read only English history and a bit of American. So discovering, in effect, I discovered all of Germany at the same time. I mean, I had a working knowledge of World War II, but that was about it. But I got a more detailed knowledge of that war and of the Holocaust at the same time that I was also learning about the Holy Roman Empire, and at the same time that I was learning about Rococo architecture and Episcopal states and 19th century mercantilism. It all came at once, and so. And a lot of that has to do with the fact of marrying in my mid-30s a European. My wife is Swiss. Her father was actually born in Hamburg. And so the marriage meant there was a discovery of a world that I had almost no contact with and very little knowledge of. And it helps in this way that she's a medievalist, that her own understanding of Europe runs back, so that we're always, as we travel, always seeing places as a kind of palimpsest of sort of sedimentary core with one layer and another layer and another layer, never just a single moment or a single era. The further back you go, the more you know that you cannot, that you can't define a place, a country, a history, in terms of a single snapshot. Even if that snapshot is 12 years long and cost us all that it has. It's a complicated thing, though, to try to hold many moments in your mind at once, and sometimes you can't. You ask about Buchenwald and Weimar, and actually that was a relatively easy thing. It's relatively easy because the paradox of Weimar and the adjacent Buchenwald has been written about before. Timothy Garton Ash has written quite beautifully about it. It's one of the stock comparisons or tensions that people who think about Germany explore. I guess what I did that was a little different was to do it not just as a paradox, but in terms of walking around from one place to another. I remember describing in the book getting into a cab and asking the cab to take me to Buchenwald, which felt sort of obscene to me.
it does sound obscene.
And yet I didn't have any other way to get there. I think there was my time was short, and there was one bus up from the city center every few hours, and I wanted to get there that morning. So in a way, if you note those kinds of incongruities, the incongruities that come as you simply go about, you do find that you can hold quite disparate things together in your mind. But it's not an easy thing, but it's possible.
Well, the somewhat equivalent of that in New York is getting into a cab and asking someone, an out-of-towner, asking the cabbie to take them to a ground zero.
Exactly.
And then we'll go for dinner.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, you do that, and then you do go to dinner.
Yes.
Because there's a part of you that thinks that daily life ought to stop, and another part that knows that it doesn't, even if you want it to. So you go to Buchenwald, or you go to Ground Zero, and maybe you do take a cab, and you go to dinner, but you're not quite the same person when you get to dinner as you were at breakfast.
And you also did say that the cabbie took that completely sans froid. He takes everybody.
He'd done it before.
Yeah, of course. That's his livelihood, to take people to the places that they come to visit.
Right.
I think what's difficult for Americans, first of all, is we have a big ocean between us and European history. And that really slows our learning down somewhat, because we're not up against it. And the other thing is that we do not have to confront the remnants of destruction. Now, the South is more in a position to do that than other parts of the country. But as a nation, we have had the luxury of being able to maintain almost a superiority that is not based on having been through the crucible. So it is perhaps why the Europeans consider Americans naive. What do you think about that?
Well, the what you said about the South, there's a famous argument about that by that C. Van Woodward, the historian from Yale, and this is an argument he first made in the 1960s, that the South was the one part of the country that had known military defeat and had seen military defeat on its own soil in the way that really every place in Europe has had. And then I think he's said, you know, Vietnam changes that a little bit. Although I think there's the revisionist accounts of Vietnam that holds that, quote, you know, we were not allowed to win there, that our army was not allowed to win, which I think is a deeply mistaken way of understanding that war. If what you've pointed to is one of the things that I find most frustrating about America, the sense that we are, you say, above it all, the sense that we are somehow exceptional, and by that I don't mean that the country doesn't provide certain exceptional opportunities, but to think of American exceptionalism as suggesting that we are somehow immune to or innocent of the catastrophes of history that every other country is subject to is one of the most pernicious and damaging myths that I think deforms our politics, our sense of ourselves, and our sense of our place in the world. We are not immune from history, and yet every time something bad happens here, you read that, well, America has lost its innocence. We've lost our innocence over and over and over again, and yet somehow seem to believe that it comes back. It's frankly childish.
One of the things that I found extraordinary in my own education was the fact that many of my teachers originated from Europe. They had been refugees, or they had been the first students in Europe after the war, musicians, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I learned about things I could never have known otherwise.
Right.
I was brought up almost intellectually in a European way. And this, of course, happened to anyone, in any number of schools that accepted refugee teachers. I remember my Italian teacher in college told me that when she and her husband got to the United States, they had nothing. And she had been a teacher, but she had no records. She didn't have her transcripts. And she said, I just had to swear that I had done what I had done. And she said, thank God they gave me a job. And the interesting thing about it is that at Christmas time, she taught us Italian Christmas carols, which was very strange for an Italian Jewish woman to be doing. But when I asked her about that, she gave me such an Italian answer. She said, there it is.
Yeah.
Now,
well, when I can add to that, when I got to Smith in 1985, there was a generation of faculty just then beginning to retire who had, in fact, been refugees, who had come to the States. Some of them had been adults when they came already. Some had been teenagers. But a generation of European refugees who had moved into the academy, who taught history here, who taught languages, I think they gave the rest of us a richer sense of the complexities of history and of the intersections of different cultures in different places. You know, and they have all now retired, and many of them are dead. But it was a deeply enriching thing about coming to this place.
This is what we need to grow intellectually. We need to learn about things that are hard to face. And we can only be thankful that we benefited from that generation of teachers. I would like to ask you now something about a writer that you refer to often in one of your chapters, Walter Benjamin, and the role of the flâneur. Okay. Now, you use the flâneur to tell some very important things in your book. First of all, can you tell us what is a flâneur, and what's the connection between the flâneur and Walter Benjamin's work, The Arcades Project?
The flâneur is a figure that originates in 19th century French literature. Benjamin associated him especially with Baudelaire. He's present in Poe as well, in a story called The Man in the Crowd. The flâneur is a wanderer in the city. There's a figure who is typically male in the classic literature on it, but a person who is walking, and walking with no necessary destination in mind. A person who is, as I say this, I have one of Alfred Kazin's early books in mind, A Walker in the City, about his experience of growing up in New York. But a person who wanders the city, noticing, pausing, lingering, absorbing the experience of urban life. Those walks are not necessarily geared to a destination. They're not geared towards any necessary kind of economic activity. They do bespeak a certain quality of leisure, though often the flâneur is not so much leisured as on or underemployed. The walks of somebody who has no particular reason for being this place rather than that. Now, for a travel writer, there's really no better person to be than a flâneur. But for Benjamin, Benjamin took the flâneur as a type of modern man. He associated the flâneur with the style of architecture that developed in Paris in the 19th century, that is the arcades, these spaces that were both inside and outside, shopping arcades that took advantage of the new steel girder construction to put long interior spaces that would yet resemble streets. We now think of them perhaps as, you know, the galleries or gallerias of contemporary shopping, but for Benjamin they were much more than shopping spaces. They were liminal spaces, neither public nor private, neither in nor out, and therefore for him definitive of modernity. And also spaces in which the flaneur might have a special place. They were places made for loitering. I find Benjamin suggestive and frustrating in equal measure. Frustrating because that almost any one of his sentences can make you linger over it for an hour, teasing out the implications, the suggestive quality. Benjamin's a great worker in fragments, and fragments always take much longer to sort through than, sometimes they take longer to sort through them than they would have taken to write. But he also suggests that, even in some ways, that we see the city in fragments, or that our job as walkers in a city is to try to assemble a whole out of the different fragments of experience we have there.
Another thing that is interesting about the flaneur is that non-arrival seems to be part of the profile. And I almost wonder whether, in describing as you did all your experiences and your ways of learning about the various levels of Germany, almost as though you were on an archaeological dig, that non-arrival is probably the goal of a successful book. Because you cannot close an idea of a country so easily. Now, I did not at the beginning say the date the book was published, which was 2004, and we are honoring it as a venerable new book because it is in the new millennium. But what's interesting now for me to ask you is, now, as a 10-year-old book, how has it been conversing with you for 10 years? And is there anything, given the benefit of hindsight, that you would have put in that you didn't put in at the time?
Well, I've got a bunch of answers to that. I reread it this morning for the first time in a number of years, and found that I actually liked it still, which was gratifying. What would I change? I think there are places that I went to that I didn't manage to get in. I had a draft chapter about a long drive through southern Germany that never quite cohered into anything, and so I hived off some glossy magazine articles from it instead.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't cohere. I wish that had been able to work, because I had some material I liked about pilgrimage churches in particular. I wish there were more people in the book. I'm not good at wandering through places and turning chance conversations into anecdote and into story. My German was not that good. I didn't want to rely on English in talking with people. I didn't do interviews with people. So I relied on things that my friends told me. There could be more people in it, and maybe fewer books, fewer things I found in the library. Although the interplay of the flaneur and the library is probably what's distinctive about the book and what has stayed with me. There are a couple of things that did come out of it. One is I think, oddly, I said at the start that I didn't want to write another book about novels, but writing some passages in this book about Buddenbrooks, about Fontana, gave me a different way of writing about fiction. It was more casual. It was less academic. It did more with plot summary and letting summary turn into commentary without yet becoming formal analysis. And I learned a lot from that. And I think that actually played into and affected the next book I wrote, my book about Henry James, Portrait of a Novel. I don't think I could have written that book, which was a trade book, was written for a general reader. I don't think I could have written that book without having written this one first.
What you wrote about Buddenbrooks taught me so much about German history, because when one reads a book in a course in university, or because one likes the author, and Thomas Mann is the author of Buddenbrooks, you're not in Lübeck, and you're not looking at the buildings. And you went to describe that red stone that was used to build the church there, or is it the cathedral?
It's a church.
Which is a very unreligious material to use for a church. And yet, Lübeck is all business.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the perfect manifestation. And without you're telling us, you're being on those streets and looking and relating, well, this is where Thomas Mann's home was. And without that actual on-the-ground information, the book would, as you say, just kind of remain literary. Instead of being something that was reflecting the real life of people in a city. I'm very grateful for that. And now I have a question for you. Has The Bells and Their Silence been translated into German?
It has not. It has not. I had some conversations with a colleague at another school who said he was interested in translating it, but without a publisher in sight, it didn't seem something that was plausible to undertake. I would be delighted, but it has not happened.
Well, perhaps it will yet, and I hope it would. I would like to say that I hope the listeners realize that this is actually a rather short book. It's 189 pages, and then it has a bibliographical chapter in case you want to read more about the books that you yourself mentioned and drew on. I felt that it was a great gift to read this book, which was filled, in addition to everything else we've talked about, with descriptions of famous paintings and paintings that became famous because of how you place them in context. Now, the one that you begin the book with, which is The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog of Caspar David Friedrich, is so well known as the ore image of Romanticism.
Yes.
Which actually began in Germany. 19th century Romanticism was its birthplace. So there are, it's like a great carpet with strands crisscrossing in all different ways. And it makes you think about today's history. It makes you remember terrible times in German history. And it shows you people who are living every day with all the pieces. And having arranged them or rearranged them and think about them, a truly reflective experience that is travel in the hugest sense, because as Proust has said, I hope I will quote this correctly, essence of travel is not to see a new place, but to see the same place with new eyes. And I want to thank you so much for letting us have new eyes on this vast subject.
Thank you.
And so much a part of our heritage as Western Europeans. I would like to ask you now, are you working on a new book?
I am indeed. I am starting a book. It will be a complete change, but a book on Faulkner and the Civil War.
Ah, well, we look forward very much to being able to read it. And I would like to say once more that the title of your book that we have been discussing today is The Bells in Their Silence, Travels Through Germany. This was published by Princeton University Press in 2004. And I want to thank Michael Gore, its author, very, very much for spending this time with us. And thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much.